Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with our update of German corporate control of the American publishing industry. In our first half-hour segment, we discussed the Bertelsmann Corporation's purchase of a key software company, which will help it to compete even more effectively with Amazon.com. Then we looked at an article from The Nation magazine's website about Bertelsmann's Nazi past, including details that the Bertelsmann firm was the largest supplier of books to the Wehrmacht and to the SS. The head of the company at that time, Heinrich Mohn, was in the SS. His son, Reinhard Mohn, the head of the company today, was a member of an elite German division called the Hermann Göring Division. I have seen reference to that as Waffen-SS. I've also seen references to that as an elite Luftwaffe division, whatever the case may be. It certainly makes Reinhard Mohn a favored figure in the eyes of the Third Reich. We then took a look at the German corporatist strategy for empire. The major German corporations and their executives worked out a pattern of cooperation with Hitler and the general staff in which German armed conquest would be used to gain favorable corporate leverage for the German corporations in the occupied countries, which would permit them to maintain economic control even in the event that they lost. The corporatist strategy for conquest in which the Germans would conquer, acquire a dominant capital position, and then re-enter the world markets rather than have the Nazi dream of a self-sufficient German empire in Central Europe realized, that corporatist plan for empire became the operating paradigm for post-World War II corporate Germany as well, in that members of the Himmlerkreis, the Himmler circle of friends, those industrialists and financiers who were close to and supportive of the SS and who were supported by the SS, they became the dominant element in reconstituting German industry and finance after World War II, along with the American industrialists and financiers who had helped in a pivotal way to capitalize Nazi Germany in the first place. In 1993 and 1994, it was my privilege to interview Professor Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants. That's a pseudonym for an individual in a firm that, basically a consulting firm, that advise small European nations and also corporations on matters European. They have an explicitly anti-fascist perspective. And in some of our discussions with Professor Stauffer, we reviewed or we discussed a couple of key aspects of German corporate and national policy. First of all, there is a very important German law which prevents any foreign corporation from owning a controlling interest in any key German company. This makes the German corporate acquisition of and control over foreign companies and foreign industries a vehicle for national hegemony, for a form of corporate imperialism. It's also worth noting that the German corporations are very German-oriented. They think of themselves as German corporations. Many key American corporations, by contrast, and their executives view themselves as members of IBM or Hewlett-Packard or General Motors or something else. The German executives and German corporatists view themselves as members of German corporations. And again, it is a very important element of German corporate law that no foreign country can own a controlling interest in any major German company. That has helped, among other things, to forestall the MAI, which is sort of like the global equivalent of GATT and NAFTA, not in and of itself a bad thing. But I was not really that worried about MAI, at least on a global sense, because I didn't think that the Germans would permit that law to be overturned, and so far, they haven't. Remains to be seen if that remains the case. Beyond that, in addition to the fact that it is an important element of German law that no foreign corporation can own a controlling interest, or no foreign element can own a controlling interest in any major German corporation, none of the German core corporations, it is worth noting that German cabinet members sit in on the board meetings of the key German corporations, and members of the boards of directors of the key German corporations sit in on German government cabinet meetings. Now, while major industry and finance always has wielded a significant influence in the national political lives of many nations, the formal, above-board, and explicit pattern of cooperation between big business and German government is literally a form of national socialism or Nazism in terms of its economic paradigm, and it gives the Germans a huge edge in terms of pursuing corporate policy as a vehicle for national imperial hegemony. It's worth bearing in mind not only those two key aspects of German political and legal life that I've talked about, the reciprocity between board members and German cabinet members in sitting on in each other's meetings, and also the fact that no foreign corporation can own a controlling interest in any major German corporation. That in conjunction with the corporatist approach to empire building that the German industrialists and financiers worked out with Hitler, those same industrialists and financiers grouped around the Himmler Kreis set the tone for German industry in the post-World War II period. And it's worth noting that the prime vehicle for this corporatist approach to empire in the post-World War II period is the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. And to make a very long story very short, Martin Bormann, the organizational genius behind Adolf Hitler and the head of the German Nazi Party in exile, and arguably the most important figure in the Third Reich, and certainly the most important figure in the Third Reich's post-World War II underground phase, Martin Bormann, anticipating German defeat, had a meeting in Strasbourg in Alsace-Lorraine in August of 1944, and at that meeting it was arranged for the Third Reich to spirit all of its major assets outside of the country to 750 corporate fronts that would be set up as subsidiaries of the major German firms. Thus, the liquid wealth of the Third Reich, including $180 billion that was looted from foreign countries, that was the second of the major tides of 20th century capital flow in the broadcast by that same name that I did earlier this year being 1998. Those 750 corporate fronts set up in neutral countries became the repository for the wealth of the Third Reich. Those 750 corporations, the focal point of an aborted U.S. intelligence operation called Operation Safe Haven, have continued to function in the post-World War II period. They later were able to transfer much of their wealth to the above-board German corporations that have become household names. It's worth noting that the significance of this is twofold. First of all, not only has the Third Reich been perpetuated into the post-World War II period, literally as real in 1998 as it was in 1938, and considerably more dangerous, in my opinion, in 1998, since people think it has disappeared. But beyond that, beneath the major German corporations, any major German corporation, when you see Siemens, Daimler-Benz, Volkswagen, or any of the major German corporate interests, Chrysler, for example, the fact of the matter is that beneath those major German corporations is the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, which continued to wield pivotal influence in the post-World War II period. And I believe that barring a change in sea change in human political affairs, the Bormann Organization is going to prove to be the dominant element in human affairs. And as I've said before, for those people who complain about my characterization in those terms, I strive for accurate analysis, not partisanship. Rather than complain about my analysis, which I try to make as accurate as possible, get up off your ever-lovins and try to change the reality rather than complain to me about my characterization of it. The definitive work on the Bormann Flight Capital Organization was done by author Paul Manning, and he wrote a landmark opus called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It was published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart Incorporated, copyright 1981. Manning was a member of the CBS News team that covered World War II in Europe for CBS News. He was a colleague of, among others, the famed Edward R. Murrow, also Walter Cronkite, the well-known television anchorman for CBS News. At one point, in order to cover the air raids in Western Europe, in which the planes could not carry any extra weight whatsoever, Manning actually trained as a waste gunner on a B-17 and was credited with shooting down an ME-109. So he was no ordinary journalist. Of the creation of the 750 corporate fronts and the spiriting abroad of all of the German capital in this German flight capital program, that capital later to serve as the foundation for the so-called German economic miracle, Paul Manning writes as follows in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. The movement of German assets into Switzerland had also gone well, Bormann noted from his reports. Flight capital investments had been accomplished principally through the establishment of subsidiaries of powerful German firms. Over half the total German capital in Switzerland was used up. It was used in setting up holding companies representing IG Farben, Merck, Siemens, Osram, Henkel, and others. A holding company may not trade in any form. It may only hold stock in other companies, but through this device, the existing German firms and the 750 new corporations established under the Bormann program gave themselves absolute control over a post-war economic network of viable, prosperous companies that stretched from the Ruhr to the neutrals, quote-unquote, of Europe and to the countries of South America. A control that continues today and is easily maintained through the bearer bonds or shares issued by these corporations to cloak real ownership. And again, bear that in mind in connection with the German corporatist approach to empire building that was favored by Hitler and the industrialists and financiers who supported him. And bear in mind, too, the great truth that Paul Manning struggled to get out, and this will sound crazy to the uninitiated, but the documentation is there. The Third Reich did not disappear. It went underground. And the key element of that is the Bormann Organization, and whenever you see a major German corporation engaged in any major enterprise beneath that corporation is the Bormann Group and the Third Reich gone underground. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, we read, "As for Martin Bormann, this now elderly recluse is ever a keen watcher and manipulator in the silent, gigantic struggles among worldwide industrial and financial powers." Bear in mind here that Manning is writing in 1981. Continuing, "Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, he, Bormann, is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power has shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10th, 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization." By the way, I would interject parenthetically, Heinrich Müller was the head of the Gestapo. Continuing, "Some still envision a Fourth Reich. This is but the dream talk of aging adventurers who will soon pass from the mortal scene." By the way, that's Manning's analysis. I do not agree. I don't think the dream of a Fourth Reich is a dream at all. I'm afraid it's going to become a reality. Continuing, "What will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann Organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry." Quote, "All orders come from the shareholders in South America," unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. And reviewing some more material that we looked at in the first pair of half-hour segments about German corporate control over American publishing, one of the major elements in the Bormann Organization is the Thyssen AG Company. By the way, I've been mispronouncing it. It's not Achting-Gesellschaft, it's Achting-Gesellschaft, I understand. But the Thyssen firm, Neue Vereinigte Stahlwerke, one of the key cartels to emerge from the American recapitalization of Germany at the end of World War I, was later renamed Thyssen AG, and when the Nazis went underground, Fritz Thyssen himself was given a anti-Nazi pedigree and later reconstituted his firm and made provisions for his family to maintain pivotal voting rights in Thyssen AG through their Latin American property holdings and through some of the corporate connections stretching through the Bormann Group to Latin America. The Thyssen Group is one of the central elements of the Bormann Organization. Of Thyssen, his post-war reconstitution of his firm and passing of control to his heirs in Latin America, we read, turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, "With everything again in his hands, Fritz Thyssen departed Europe in January of 1950. First, he paid a visit to Thyssen AG, which had undergone a rebirth since the bombings of World War II when it was 90% demolished. But under the management of Dr. Hans Günther Sohl, S-O-H-L, today chairman of the advisory board and chief executive of Thyssen AG, the mills were again producing at capacity. En route to South America, Thyssen stopped off in London to check his British holdings and bank statements. He then proceeded to Buenos Aires." By the way, Thyssen spelled capital T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. Continuing, "During the final year of his life in Argentina, dividing his time between the Villa in Buenos Aires and the ranches, one in Argentina, the other in Paraguay, Fritz Thyssen completed establishing the control that would assure everlasting family prosperity through Thyssen AG. Elder grandson Count Federico Zichy Thyssen of Buenos Aires was placed on the board of this German steel trust. When they count votes at board meetings in Dusseldorf three or four times a year, he votes for the entire Thyssen family of South America and Europe. Count Federico Zichy-Thiessen, who has a younger brother, Count Claudio Zichy-Thiessen, represents the largest single shareholding group with 25% of the stock of Thiessen AG. The remainder of the stock is diffused into Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt and Buenos Aires, which holds shares for many individuals on both continents, including those representing the Bormann Group. And more about the close connections between the Thiessen heirs and Martin Bormann himself. Again, bear in mind this book was published in 1981. Turning again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, Count Federico Zichy-Thiessen, grandson of old Fritz Thiessen, Claudio Zichy-Thiessen, and their families are intimate friends of Bormann. Because of this friendship, Martin Bormann has three sanctuaries, his own pampa spread in Argentina, and the Thiessen ranches in Argentina and Paraguay. Bear in mind, too, that there are strong areas of overlap between the Bertelsmann Corporation that dominates American publishing, along with the von Holtzbrinck firm, and the Thiessen firm, one of the central elements of the Bormann Group, and one of the central elements of German heavy industry. Turning now to the book Global Dreams, Imperial Corporations and the New World Order, a book published by Richard J. Barnett and John Cavanaugh, and copyright 1994 by Simon & Schuster, we read of Bertelsmann. Speaking of Gerd Schulte-Hillen, he is a key Reinhard Mohn protege. Bear in mind, Reinhard Mohn, a member of the elite Hermann Göring division in World War II, his father, the head of the Bertelsmann firm, was in the SS. Gerd Schulte-Hillen is a sophisticated worldly man who speaks several European languages. He started in the company as a young man, ran the company's printing operation in Spain, and quickly became one of Reinhard Mohn's protégés, along with Mark Wosner, the chief executive officer, and Dieter Vogel, V-O-G-E-L, now the head of the great Thiessen industrial complex. So bear in mind the Thiessen-Bormann-Bertelsmann link that I've just discussed. What we're going to do next is to turn to a book that I've talked about quite a bit over the last several years. This is an obscure Nazi tract called Serpent's Walk, authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall. This book purports to be a novel about a Nazi takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century by the descendants of the SS who infiltrate the army, put together a capital organization, buy into and eventually control the American opinion-forming media, and eventually take over the country after an attack by genetically engineered viruses of ostensibly Russian origin wipes out much of the country. I've spoken about this book in the past. It's published by National Vanguard Books. That's the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important domestic American Nazi group. National Vanguard Books, by the way, also the publisher of the Turner Diaries by William Pierce, the blueprint for the Nazi Order group, you know, for the Nazi group The Order in the 1980s. Also purportedly the book for Timothy McVeigh and company in the Oklahoma City bombing as well. Again, this book is purportedly a novel. I've stated in the past I think it's far more than the novel it is supposed to be. The back cover of Serpent's Walk describes the book, basically. The good guys win sometimes. Not always, of course. They lost big in the Second World War. That war was a victory for communists, Democrats, and Jews, but everyone else lost, including millions of GIs who were told that they were killing Germans and Japanese in order to make the world a decent place for their children to grow up, only to see things in America go from bad to much, much worse in the decades after the war. Even when the bad guys win, they sometimes grow careless and later become losers. Look what happened to the communists of Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Could the same thing happen to their erstwhile World War II allies in America? Serpent's Walk explores that possibility. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. And again, much of this book is not fiction. The SS did go underground. They did begin building up their economic muscle in the person of the Bormann organization and related elements. And note here what this book is about. Their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion forming media. Well, that is exactly, in my opinion, what has been happening. And that is the significance of the German corporate control of American publishing. In this book, a member of the Underground Reich, and again, this book is supposedly taking place in the mid-21st century, and again, I don't think this is the novel it purports to be, but rather I think it's a blueprint, a manifesto, not unlike the way the Turner Diaries has turned out to be a blueprint for much Nazi activity. I think this book is a blueprint as well. This is the discussion between a mercenary named Lessing, who eventually becomes a convert to the Nazi cause, and a fellow named Wrench, who's a member of the Underground Reich. And Wrench describes the going underground. In 1945, when Germany lost, two submarines arrived in Argentina. Some of the remaining senior officers of the SS were aboard. They brought money, lots of money, a good part of the treasury of the Third Reich. People thought it was lost or stolen down in Bavaria, but it wasn't, skipping down. They founded a colony, set up businesses, made connections. Later, they invested, linked up, developed. They built a series of interlocking corporations. The post-war boom and the recovery of Germany helped those corporations become conglomerates, then huge international holding companies based in the goddamnedest places. And again, this is obviously to a knowledgeable observer of the Bormann Organization. Skipping down again. Yes, everything neat and tidy, out of sight, away from the Jews and the Nazi hunters and their network of financial institutions and pressure groups. The Third World made it easier. There are fewer controls here, fewer restrictions, fewer checks, fewer regulations, fewer watchdog agencies. Less hassle with privacy. You can spot outsiders coming. And skipping down again. They, the SS and their descendants, made friends in local governments. The Third Worlders needed know-how, money, connections, and expertise. And skipping down again. The SS, what was left of it, had business objectives before and during World War II. When the war was lost, they just kept on, but from other places. Bogota, Asunción, Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, Mexico City, Colombo, Damascus, Dakar, you name it. They realized that the world is heading towards a corporocracy, 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. And skipping down, we, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining. And skipping down again, about 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a supercorp that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly, not with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great bleeping amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around, too. Not much, but a little so it won't show. And skipping down, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. And again, as you watch these huge corporations gently cuddling up to one another and munching each other up like a great big amoeba, bear in mind not only the Bormann Organization, but the book Serpent's Walk, which in my opinion, again, is not the novel it purports to be, but is a blueprint for what is going on and what has gone on. Remember the German corporatist plan for empire building, which was established during the Hitler period and perpetuated through the Himmler Kreis and related elements and the Bormann Group in the post-World War II period. And bear in mind, again, that it is an important element of German corporate law that no foreign element, no corporation or government or individual can own a controlling interest in any of the German core corporations. And in turn, German cabinet members, government cabinet members, sit in on the members of on the board of directors meetings of those core corporations, and members of the boards of directors of those core corporations sit in on German cabinet meetings, formalizing and accentuating, amplifying the cooperation between big business and finance and government in a way that does not exist in any other society. So as one watches these German corporations, which at this point control American publishing, bear in mind the Serpent's Walk scenario and bear in mind the tremendous vehicle for national hegemony that these represent. We're going to review a short section of an article that I reviewed last week, and this was originally read into the record in a pair of half-hour segments entitled German Corporate Acquisitions in the United States. And it was then read back into the record during the aforementioned pair of half-hour segments recorded last week entitled German Corporate Control Over American Publishing. The article that you're going to hear excerpted is from Vanity Fair's issue of June of 1998. The article is entitled The German Front, and it's by David Margolick, M-A-R-G-O-L-I-C-K, and it's about the George von Holtzbrinck publishing empire that rivals Bertelsmann. Bear in mind as you listen to the excerpt that you're about to listen to that George von Holtzbrinck, the head of the firm, had joined the Nazi Party in Germany 2 years before Hitler came to power, profited handsomely from his close association with Nazi Germany, then had a trivial detail lead to an ostensible break with the Third Reich, characteristic of the pattern that we saw with regard to Third Reich individuals and institutions that were to be utilized in the post-World War II underground phase. And then in the post-World War II period, von Holtzbrinck employed liberal numbers of SS men in his publishing outfits, including at least one notorious former associate of Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry. That is a pattern very similar to the Bertelsmann firm, which, like von Holtzbrinck, or along with von Holtzbrinck, dominates American publishing and English-language publishing at this point in time. After a discussion of Bertelsmann's corporate holdings, there is a discussion of von Holtzbrinck's holdings, which includes St. Martin's Press, again, Henry Holt & Company, Scientific American, and Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Note again the similarity in the patterns of von Holtzbrinck firm and Bertelsmann. Again, this article from Vanity Fair's issue of June of 1998, The German Front, by David Margolick. Bearing in mind the similarities between the careers of the von Holtzbrinck and Bertelsmann firms, as you listen to that, listen also very closely for the name Michael Naumann, because we're going to come back to Michael Naumann in just a minute. But the German blitzkrieg of American book publishing doesn't end there. More quietly, but just as insistently, a second German media conglomerate has amassed its own considerable stake in the business. It is wholly owned by three siblings from Stuttgart who are nearly as mysterious in their native country as they are in the United States. They are the von Holtzbrinks. In American publishing these days, they are the other Germans. And skipping down, talking about some of the acquisitions of the von Holtzbrinck Publishing Company. Since 1985, the Holtzbrinks have pumped at least $300 million into the United States and quietly acquired three of New York's premier book publishing houses, Henry Holt & Company, St. Martin's Press, and the most glittering jewel, Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Already, Dieter, that's Dieter von Holtzbrinck, already Dieter has made waves and raised doubts in the U.S. by appointing a brash German publisher for Holt, Michael Naumann. Note that Michael Naumann eventually left Henry Holt & Company because he proved to be too abrasive. However, Michael Naumann, by the way, this is live, that article again, Vanity Fair, June of 1998, The German Front, by David Margolick, Michael Naumann has found a new area of employment. Turning to the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, December 15th of 1998, we find the following story, a Washington Post story, datelined Berlin, headlined, Germany's Memorial Plan Reset. This is about a plan, by the way, to redesign the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. The previous plan had been for a ponderous concrete sculpture. The new one is supposed to be interactive. But note who German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder has appointed to oversee this. Skipping down in this story, again, San Jose Mercury, 12-15-98. Michael Naumann, Schroeder's designated culture minister, has scorned the concept as a wreath dumping ground whose grandiose scale recalls the projects of Hitler's favorite architect, Albert Speer. That is the same Michael Naumann who had previously been appointed by the von Holtzbrinck firm to head up Henry Holt & Company. Now, the designated culture minister of Germany, or is it the United States? I find him confusing. Anyway, that concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.